Senator Dockstader? Excused? Excused? Excused. Here. Thank you, Don. Good morning. Welcome. It's Friday. I want everybody to remember that all day long, because after Friday comes the day we can work and get caught up. Right, Brett?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair, you got any words of wisdom before we start this wonderful day?
No.
It's all my deal. I'll remember that you told me that.
Yeah. Until we get to vote.
You are.
You only have three today.
Okay, good morning. Brett, welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This morning, I was elected by the what I would call the triumvirate down at A&I, which would be my boss, Mr. Fawcett, and a couple of other of the key players down there to assist you or go through with you to the degree that you would like to do so, the board and commission budget changes. I did prepare a handout for that that might facilitate our discussion of that, as opposed to requiring you to page through the various board budgets. It is number 156. I believe it was distributed this morning. And it is a summary of the changes reflected in the various board and commission budgets.
Hold on 1 second, Brett. Have we got that, 156? Has everybody got it? Let us get a hold of this. Here we go. Okay, I got it now. Okay, everybody got it?
No.
Let's find it. Everybody got it?
No.
Oh, okay. Time out. While we're looking for it, Brett, we're gonna try to do these all at once. And good, okay. All right, does everybody have it? Okay, we'll hold on. Are we good to go? Okay, Brett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a summary of the impacts of the supplemental budget with respect to the ETS. Consolidation. The numbers, I do need to emphasize that all of the numbers entered into these budgets were done on the basis of interaction between the budget division and ETS as a part of the consolidation effort. So when these numbers appeared to each of these boards and commissions, these changes appeared in their budgets. These are not changes that were driven by those folks. These were driven by IT consolidation. What we've prepared for you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, is a summary of those changes for these 13 boards and commissions. We have provided to you a listing of them with their agency number, as well as the page number within their supplemental budget where these changes are reflected. And then on the right-hand side in the final column, the amount of the request or the transfer between series. In each instance, there is a movement of funds contained within the supplemental budget from the 410 object code to the 0301 object code. Essentially, that shift represents a reduction in the 410 object code related to ETS's provision of support services to each of these boards. Specifically, each of these boards has previously had an arrangement with ETS for them to provide support services to them through a gold or silver plan, essentially. And historically, ETS has invoiced each of these boards and commissions for those services. As a result of this shift from the 410 object code to 0301, which is cost allocation, the cost of those services will now be recovered via the statewide cost allocation plan as opposed to a direct invoice by ETS to the board. So that's essentially the gist of this change with respect to these 13 boards and commissions and their budgets in the supplemental.
Tell us more about the statewide cost allocation plan and how that will actually work. Follow it through, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The statewide cost allocation plan is a document that is put together by the Budget Division on an annual basis. It's our methodology with assistance, quite frankly, from the Deputy Director of A&I, who has a considerable amount of experience in this area. And it's our effort that we do annually, working with the federal government. It's our methodology for recovering both federal and other funds from agencies who receive federal funds or are funded by other funds and receive services that are the cost of which are fronted by the general fund. So an example of some of those services would be archiving, would be all of the accounts payable and payroll services that those individuals would receive from the state auditor's office. So any services that within the context of the budget are generally funded, this is our methodology for recovering the cost to the general fund. The general fund, in other words, fronts those costs, and then we use the statewide cost allocation plan to allocate those costs across agencies, and we ultimately invoice them once a year to recover funds for the general fund from those other sources of funding.
So, Brett, what you'd be doing is that you would be you still would be invoicing, it'd be just one time a year, and like if you took the, just for talking purposes, the real estate commission, it's $1,728. There'll be an invoice at the end of the year that you will, that they will send, ETS will send to them. They will reimburse, and that comes from their funds that they, where they charge the dues and kind of pretty much run on their own anyway. And that's how that'll work.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Instead of them receiving a periodic invoice,
so once a year,
from ETS, they will receive an invoice from the budget division once a year.
Okay. And that's on the 13 that we have here.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Anybody have any questions on that? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, quite frankly, that's the summary of the changes for these 13 boards and commissions. I don't know if there are any other questions. They, each of these boards and commissions were requested to submit 600 and 900 series, and I believe you have that information in front of you. I'm not in a position to be intimately familiar with how they expend their dollars, so they're all here today. If there are questions on any of the submittals that they provided to you, I would defer to them to respond to those.
Yeah, and essentially the way this works is that, of course, they're self-regulating in the sense that they charge dues to their members. They collect those, and they run based on their own associations and how they want to hire, what they want to pay their director. And then what we do budget-wise is we kind of have a system set up about the amount of money that they should spend, but it's really up to them, and their budget is, the budget we approve is what they want us to approve, and that's, is that how it works?
Mr. Chairman, in a general sense, yes, it is. I do need to make one other distinction for you. There are two subsets of the boards and commissions. Some boards and commissions do hire staff, do operate fairly independently. There's another subset of boards and commissions that operate with support from the Professional Licensing Board Division of A&I. So some of them we are not large enough or don't generate enough revenue in and of themselves to be able to operate in an independent fashion. They do pay for those services, however, from the Professional Licensing Board Division in A&I. And that falls under the guidance of Rory Horsley, who's the A&I Fiscal Director, and Veronica Skoransky, who essentially heads up that particular portion of the agency. So they collectively, they provide support for a number of different boards and are invoiced against their revenues to pay for the services that they receive from that entity.
Okay, and if they periodically need the services of an attorney, they either have the ability to do what they want internally, privately, go to, or they can go to the AG's office and they're billed. Is that correct? Is that how that would work?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct.
Do they have actually assigned attorneys to represent them from the AG? Or are they just kind of as-needed basis? I see a lot of nodding their heads, so I think we have the answer to that. Okay. Anybody have any questions? Sue.
Mr. Chairman, are these questions in regards to any of the boards, or are we going down through them one by one? How are we?
I don't know that we need to go through them one by one.
Okay.
I think if you have a specific question, please ask it, and if Brett can't answer it, maybe there would be somebody here that could.
Great. Then I think that what I'd appreciate is a little bit of an update on the two boards that we did have some discussion about last go-around, being the midwifery and the animal euthanasia.
Brett, go ahead.
In their situation now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, I do know we have an item on the agenda after this more general discussion related to the Board of Animal Euthanasia. I'll try to give the committee a little bit of background on our conversations last year with respect to not only that board, but also the Board of Midwifery. Last year, during discussions with the Joint Appropriations Committee, the two boards and commissions that came up, there were a lot of questions about their sustainability, specifically with respect to their revenue and the ability of that revenue, that fee and licensing revenue, to maintain the operations of those boards. And I'll start with the Board of Midwifery, and I'm not sure if they're represented here today or not, quite frankly. I can give you some general background on those discussions, but if we get into any specifics, I'm probably going to need to defer to someone else. But specifically, there was a lot of discussion about the sustainability of both of these boards during the last Joint Appropriations Committee. I don't know all of the details, don't have them on the top of my head, but the Board of Midwifery does not do a lot of licensing. Their revenue stream is very limited. I think it's less than $2,000 a biennium, potentially, or maybe that's per year. Their revenue stream, less than maybe a couple thousand dollars a biennium. Yeah, thank you. Seven license holders. And so with respect to the services that they receive from, I think the Professional Licensing Board provides support to them, there's just a real question of whether they generate enough revenue to sustain their operations. I believe, additionally, I am not sure their board members, I'm not sure they have a Wyoming board member, is that correct? And so there's the level of activity there is just, it was a topic of discussion last year in terms of being able to sustain their operations.
I'm going to interrupt you. Would you please just come up and sit by the mic and identify yourself? Just so people out there understand, when Brett turns his head, Wyoming doesn't understand what he's doing. And identify yourself and just let's do this again so it's on the record and we can have it recorded, please. Would you identify yourself?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Rory Horsley. I'm the accounting administrator for the Department of A&I.
Thank you. And as I understand it, the midwifery has seven participating members, and it's about a $2,000 revenue stream, and there's some issues about them, their ability to continue to fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I'm not sure specifically what their license fees are for their license holders, but they have a limited number and not really the ability to be self-sustaining.
Okay, thank you. Just please stay there in case there's more questions. Go ahead, Brett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In addition to this particular board, the Animal Euthanasia Board also came up in the course of discussions last year with Joint Appropriations.
You know, Brett, that's on the agenda separately. Let's just take that one separately. Is that okay? Okay. All right, committee members, any other questions on this? Any other questions? Anybody in the audience that represents all of these various boards and committee or professional licensing would like to testify or make any comments? Anybody want to going once? Okay. Well, thanks for all showing up. And nothing else? Okay. That takes care of that. Thank you all. Let's move on to now the euthanasia. The floor is yours, Brett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the Board of Animal Euthanasia, a little bit of background on this board. I was not in my present position at the time this was created. Actually, I happened to be in local government at the time, so I have a little bit of that perspective from why this board was created, although I certainly can't speak to how it occurred at the state government level. But it was created, I believe, in 2004. There were some issues, I think, stemming from the ability of local governments specifically to euthanize animals in animal shelters. I believe it was driven a little bit by issues in various parts of the state related to the availability of those services from veterinarians, and given their workloads, their ability potentially to do this on behalf of animal shelters. And at the time, I believe there was legislation drafted that created this board and created a process by which non-veterinarians could essentially be certified or receive a license to be able to euthanize animals. And the situation that exists today, there's a couple of situations. First of all, again, this is another board where there's some question about whether or not the revenue stream will be able to sustain the expenses associated with the licensing of individuals. I think there's a history of that revenue stream continuing to fall, although I apologize I don't have those specifics for you, Mr. Chairman, but we can certainly get them if you'd like to see them. I think from your perspective, probably more importantly, when this board was originally created, the board was set up from a fiscal perspective. Their first appropriation was from the budget reserve account, and from 2004 until actually last year, this board, which would have otherwise have spent been in a deficit situation, has actually drawn on the balance in the budget reserve over the period of time from its original appropriation. And so last spring, there was some dialogue between the budget division, the legislative service office, fiscal staff, and the state auditor's office about the circumstances that had been created by this draw. And so over 7 or 8 years, essentially drew a deficit of a little over $47,000 from the budget reserve account, because this was not caught by budget division personnel, LSO fiscal, or state auditor's office. And actually, I think it was the auditor's office, perhaps, that brought this up to all of our attention last spring. And so in our dialogue with the auditor's office, as well as with LSO fiscal, one of the potential solutions to this, I believe, was to draft a footnote for the appropriations bill that would address this $47,527 draw, unauthorized draw, effectively, on the budget reserve account. And so I know your staff probably has some perspective on this, as well as potential solutions to this, and we wanted to at least have an opportunity to discuss it with the committee and talk through essentially where we're headed with that particular issue.
Thanks, Brett. What we'll do is, Don, you have some comments, and then I think Sue has some questions, and we'll get to Sue. So go ahead, Don.
Mr. Chairman, you do have a handout on this. It's number 155. It's a memo from myself to the chairs of the committee. I think the background is similar to what or identical, actually, to what Mr. Jones described. In the second half of the memo, I articulate three potential options for resolution, one of which is essentially no action, and I think not wanting to speak directly for them, but the state auditor's office has no burning concern to see any action taken. So that's why that option is included in there. Option two is the proposed amendment, which is also drafted there. Essentially, that option would take money from the left pocket and put it in the right pocket. The advantage of this option is it provides a paper audit trail in the event that anyone asks questions in future years as to the expenditure of those funds, and it also preserves the notion that funds can only be appropriated, funds can only be spent if appropriated by the legislature. Then option three brings in what this committee has done in some limited circumstances with respect to a payment plan, that is increase the fees on those certified individuals over the next decade or so, to attempt to recoup the foregone funds. There are pros and cons with that option. For example, the certified individuals were not responsible for this overspending, and they would be financially responsible for the cleanup. I'll conclude there.
Okay, Sue, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I have any questions, but I do have an alternative to propose, and that is that Senator Emmerich, or it might possibly even be a committee bill out of agriculture, is contemplating a certification program for veterinary technicians, that this would, so my alternative would be to visit with him and the committee, ask them to include animal euthanasia as part of the scope of practice for veterinary tech certification, and eliminate this board.
Yeah, Sue, and I think that's Senator Emmerich's bill. It's a personal bill. I don't think it's a committee bill. But even if we did that, Don, we still have that the paper trail for the amount of money that's happened over the last 10 years or whatever. And I'm not sure that it's fair for us to have them pay for a mistake that really wasn't theirs. So if we did and put that in the that bill of Senator Emmerich's, assuming it passes, we still have to deal with this issue. So I'm inclined to for us to just visit generally about which way we want to go, and of course we won't do it today. But is that correct, Donald? Do you agree,
Mr. Chairman? Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Perkins.
If we could just I have a passing familiarity with the issue that happened with the with the livestock board, but can you? I just have a question, general question, as far as the one option, as far as option two, and I don't understand why does that create a better audit trail than what we have now?
Don?
Mr. Chairman, and I think the State Auditor's Office might argue this same point, but at minimum, it would not affect the profile, but we would put in the budget bill an amendment showing that the general fund is going to repay the budget reserve account, which is essentially one fund anyway because of all of the transfers back and forth. But it would at least acknowledge that these funds, $47,000, have been spent. And if an outside auditor comes in and says, well, what authority did you have to expend these funds, at least there would be something to point to that indicated that the legislature was aware of that and attempted to rectify the situation after the fact.
Okay, Senator Hastert, I believe this is one of your entities. Do you have any questions that you would like to ask? Okay. Any questions of Brett from the committee? Is Joanne here? Would you like to say anything or make any comments, ma'am? If you do, please come up and identify yourself, turn on the mic, and be glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joanne Reed. I'm the executive director for 7 boards. Animal Euthanasia Technicians is one of those boards. In response to Representative Wallace in including this in the scope of practice for the veterinary technicians, there is also a current draft or a bill that has been introduced, Senate File 39, I believe it is, that actually is addressing including animal euthanasia into the Veterinary Medicine Practice Act. The veterinarians are willing to take over this board and support them, and that's basically just what I wanted to point out for that.
Yeah, and one of the options is if we don't, where is it here? Yeah, if we try to have you pay for it, that might interfere with, I don't think the vets would like to pick up your $47,000 liability. I mean, they want to pick up liabilities. I've got a few of my own I could give to them.
So no, I don't think the vets would be very happy with that.
That's a foregone conclusion. So I think you're comfortable with looking at least at option two, and then whatever the legislature decides to do, it makes sense to probably roll them in, is what you're saying as well.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
To do that. Okay. Anybody else? Thanks, Joanne. Anybody else on euthanasia, animal euthanasia? Did you get off easy this morning, Brett? We got Brett sitting in the hot seat. Anybody got anything else for him? I got a list of about 25 things, but it is Friday. Okay, thanks for that. We'll move on. Thanks, everybody, for coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I think next we have the retirement board. Is that correct? We're a little ahead of schedule. That's the way the Senate operates, Co-Chairman Harshman.
We appreciate it.
You know, we get things done. Let's just stand at ease till we get the retirement board in here. There we go. Now I'm on. Okay, welcome back. We're here to talk about retirement. Please identify yourself, and we look forward to your comments.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. We are, in fact, delighted to be back to testify and to discuss the retirement system with the members of this committee. My name is Thomas Williams, and I'm the executive director of the Wyoming Retirement System. And accompanying me this morning, to my immediate right, is Steve Summers, who many of you know. He is the current chair of the Wyoming Retirement System Board. I am also accompanied by several other representatives from our organization. Primary amongst them would be Polly Scott, who is a manager of our deferred compensation program and oversees many of our communications activities. Amy Anama, who is our communications officer and has helped to prepare a number of the materials that we have provided and will discuss with you today. And also Leslie Thompson. Leslie is to my immediate left in the seat behind here, who represents Gabriel Roeder Smith, and that's our actuarial firm. And many of you have gotten to know more about actuarial concepts than perhaps you'd ever thought you would or even desired. But I think you'll hear a little bit more about it today. Let me, if I might, just begin with a couple of observations. I just really personally and on behalf of our board want to thank this committee, its membership, current and former, for the attention that you have afforded this retirement system. I've been with the system about 4.5 years, and I have overseen, you've been a part of enormous improvement and change in terms of the structure of our system, the funding of our system, the investment practices of our system, the governance of our system. And I am just personally enormously proud of what we've been able to accomplish. And I'm very confident that we're on a direction that will cause the system to rise to be one of the most well-funded, most admired, most reliable retirement systems in the nation. And I, again, am extremely confident in that regard. The support that this committee has shown, that our governor has shown, past and present, for the sustainability and support of this plan has to be noted. Also, the membership. We've been around the state, quite frankly, talking about the status of our program, and we describe it as one of the strongest in the country, and it's been acknowledged as such by other organizations, organizations that have a role in evaluating and assessing the status and quality of these plans. And, you know, that's something that we take very dearly, and we're going to try to sustain, and we believe we can. We also are, on behalf of the board, I said the staff and others, the membership, we're acutely sensitive to the competing interests in which this retirement system operates. We understand the fiscal realities, political, economic realities, and the retirement system is but one of those, quite frankly, an important one, I might say. But you all have the difficult challenge of trying to weigh the prioritization of the many challenges that come before this particular body. And while we are so grateful for the support that has been evidenced to move this plan to 100% funding in the context of providing the contribution increases that are necessary to get it there, we want to convey a strong sense of not only appreciation but of flexibility in the context of how that is to be achieved. The retirement system necessarily takes a long-term perspective on its future. We hope and will be here in perpetuity. And the kind of changes we attempt to respond to are not those immediate that occur day to day, but those that occur over a long time that are discernible. And that's the reason why we've made some changes in the context of the underlying assumptions underpinning our program. There are demographic assumptions that we've acknowledged as it relates to increasing life expectancies and different hiring rates and the like. And there are also some economic assumptions that we have modified, the board has, to reflect the expected investment return environment going forward. But we didn't do that, you know, after a 30-day examination. We've been contemplating these things for many, many months, and in some instances actually well over a year or so. So in the context of the introduction of the kind of contribution increases that we think are warranted and so much appreciated and will achieve the result that we are all targeting, we want to just convey a strong sense of flexibility, whether this occurs September 1 of 2013 or 2014, we can give you numbers. We can calculate the impacts of these kind of changes. But the most important thing from our perspective is that those kind of increases at some appropriate time will occur. We have a strong sense of your commitment in that regard and of all the other stakeholders. We have provided a number of pieces of information in response to our last visit. We were asked to, answer a couple of questions as they relate to IRS limits. Some folks have inquired as to, how much salary? I mean, at what level can we and are we required to make contributions? And what is the maximum benefit level that this program can pay? Is it unlimited? Is it $1 million or what? And I think we had provided earlier a December 31 memo that I believe you all have that answers those questions. First, in regards to the amount of maximum compensation that can be considered for defined benefit plan purposes, it's $255,000. And the maximum benefit that the IRS permits these programs to pay is $205,000. And, of course, there is a sense, perhaps misguided, perhaps not, but around the country that these defined benefit plans are paying enormously rich benefits to its membership. And I would argue that there are, in some cases, that to be true, but they're generally rare. And one of the reports that we've got in your provided in your materials that I'd refer you to was also requested because there was a question raised as to the level of benefits our programs are paying. And what you'll see, if you'll share with me and go to the illustration, does everyone have
everybody
access?
That's handout 95, I think. Does everybody have that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're looking first at the public employee pension plan. And we've done, with Amy's wonderful assistance, provided some very attractive graphs, well beyond anything I might personally be able to develop. But it shows you the distribution in terms of members in the plan and the benefits that they receive. And I refer you primarily, because there are so many gradations here, I refer you to the far right for each of these programs. And you'll see we've got the game wardens and judicial and all represented here. And all of those plans have different benefit formulas and different retirement ages, different provisions, if you will, and different contribution rates. But if we look first at the public employee pension plan, what you'll see in the lowest benefit, and God knows, I don't know how the person is supporting him or herself, but I suspect there must be other sources of income. $13 a month, about $156 a year. The average is $1,300 plus a month. That's $16,000 a year. The median is about $12,000. And the highest benefit that's paid by the big plan, if you will, is $131,000. But if you were to look just below that, a breakdown of the earners, what you'll see that 83% of our retirees earn less than $30,000 a year. 64% earn $18,000 a year or less. 50% earn $12,000 or less. And 43% earn $9,000 or less a year. And we all know the pressures that on expenses, health care, and otherwise that retirees are exposed to. I think what you'll see is that the sense that our program is providing extraordinarily rich benefits is not supported by the data, quite frankly. And I think you'll see here that we have 11 individuals in the program who earn benefits of $100,000 or more. 11. We did not try to identify them in terms of their confidential personal information, but I suspect that those might be superintendents or coaches or presidents of particular institutions. I'm uncertain, and I'm not attempting to identify them. But mostly what we want to convey is a sense that this program is achieving its end in terms of providing a reasonable retirement benefit to its membership, along with the other benefits that you support, Social Security, as well as the 457 deferred compensation plan, which is an increasingly important component of an individual's retirement security. And this particular chart illustrates the benefit levels for each of our programs. And at this particular juncture, I'd just offer to answer any questions that may arise as it relates to these documents.
Any questions? Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, one of the areas of discussion relates to the potential contributions for the retirement system. I believe we were charged with the responsibility of calculating the impact of possible increases in the program of 2% in one fiscal year and an additional 2% subsequent. And we actually have some documents that I believe you also, I know we provided, but this is more recent. It's a January 10th document that actually looks at our program as it, our programs, I should say.
Time out for a second, Tom. Does everybody have that?
Is that 154? And 153 is the January 3rd, handout 154?
We're looking at a January 10th. It was sent over yesterday.
Okay, does everybody... Everybody but me.
Should I give them mine? Do you have an extra? Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Referring to this particular document, we're looking at the status, the funding status of the major programs that the Wyoming Retirement System administers. And it shows in the left column chart at the bottom of the page, 2012 versus 2042, the 30-year amortization period that we employ in measuring the fiscal health of the retirement system and all of its component plans. What you'll see is that our funding ratio as of January 1, 2012 was 81.9%. And what we show here is that with our current assumptions, and when I say assumptions, we're talking about earnings, these economic assumptions, as well as the demographic assumptions as they relate to mortality, et cetera, our program would expect to have about an 87.17% or 87.1% funding ratio over that 30-year time frame. Of course, the board as well as this committee has charged us with targeting 100% funding as our goal. And despite whatever the funding goals are, there are certain realities that we've got to recognize, and they relate to those changing demographics, the longer life expectancies of our retirees. They're receiving benefits longer than were anticipated when they were first employed. And there are a number of other things in terms of inflation rates and payroll growth rates and the like. But all of those assumptions have been... Yes, one of the observations is that when we look at the 2012 funding ratios, they have been... and particularly going forward, we have to assume what the earnings are going to be. And the earnings rate assumed generally is 8% under the current set of assumptions. But we were able to update these projections for going forward with the approximate 12-plus percent that we earned this past year. The retirement system has not had its final numbers communicated as yet. Many of our investments are publicly marketed. Others are less liquid, and the kind of information as to their current market value is being received as we speak. So we won't have the final audited investment performance number for the system for probably another perhaps 30 days. But we do know with great confidence that we've earned over 12% for this last year. And that's based on an assumption of 8%.
Representative Moniz.
Does that 12% for all of the funds or just the state plan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's for all the funds. We actually pool the investments so they are not segregated by plan. So every plan would participate proportionally in the earnings that accrue on an annual basis.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, just to add a little bit to that.
Identify yourself, please.
Steve Summers, Chairman of the Board. Because I see Representative Harshman getting kind of a puzzled look on his face. and some of you may recall that when we have provided you with a 2042 figure in the past, it never really broke the 80% plane. You know, our original projections were to drop from 82% to approximately 80%, and then that line just stayed constant all the way out. The only difference that we have made, and the only number we have changed to get to that 87%, was to plug in a 12% rate of return as a proxy for 2012 rather than using 8%. 8% from then on out. So what the point of this is, or what I want to make is how incredibly important that rate of return is to the funding status, and how in any one year it can make a huge effect, especially when it's the current year and you're projecting off of that for 30 years. It has a major effect. But that's the only difference between what we've been showing you and what that 87% represents. It's huge.
Well, we're going to try, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, just on this, on your, what I'm looking at on your page one, and just to be sure I'm understanding, I think I got it. You've got the state plan current assumptions, which would be your 8% internal rate of return and whatever you've had going up to this point. And it indicates we're at 81.9, 87.1 by 2042. But if we go with the proposed assumptions, which you're saying is a 7.75% internal rate of return and an investment rate of 12% for 12, it will be 79.9%, and moving forward in 2042, 59.5%. Is the mortality rate included in this as well?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
You're both nodding your heads. Okay, the other question I have, and of course why we're doing this, is I think we all have a tremendous fiduciary responsibility to ensure that this retirement fund is actuarially sound. I mean, it's not the legislative retirement fund. It belongs to the employees, and we want to do all we can. And I do not take that responsibility lightly, and I know none of you do either. That's why we're having this conversation. The question I have next is about the bust of 09, and I'm new to this in terms of how that flows through your calculations, but it's like a bubble moving through the system, and it's a real negative impact. Has that gone through the system on the top one that you're proposing? How does that fit into this, or does it? And what I'm saying is, you know, I understand numbers and how that works. So as a bad year goes through, it has a negative impact. But when it rolls out, then you should see a kind of a hit in the opposite direction, making it look better. What's the status of that in any of these numbers?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for asking that question. I'm sure it's one that is shared by a number of your colleagues, and obviously our board is acutely monitoring that as well. The answer is that negative impacts and positive impacts to the retirement system are smoothed over a five-year period. So gains or losses in excess or under the 8% are smoothed. And in 2008, we lost about 30% of our assets, quite frankly. And that translates into about $418, $19 million a year of losses that we've been amortizing over this five-year smoothing period. The last year for those losses is 2012. So about $418 million is reflected, will be reflected in the 1/1/13 evaluation, because we do it looking back to the just ended calendar year. So our new actuarial valuation is generally prepared in about April of the year, and it has all of the finalized financial results and earnings results from all of our managers. And so what we've given you here is our estimate, but a reliable one, based on the information that we've been able to get from our managers. So you're absolutely right. These impacts, good and bad, are smooth. The 2008 downturn of approximately 30% is reflected here, and this should be the last of it. But can there be another 2008? I pray not. And we've had positive investment returns on average since 2008, but it's volatile year to year. In 2011,
I believe we had a modest loss. And what seems like a modest loss gets exacerbated because we're assuming 8. So if you have a negative 1, you're really down 9. And the same thing with the 30% decline in 2008. If we're assuming an 8% return, we're down more like 38%.
So what you're saying then, that bubble as it moves through the system that is calculated through 12/31 of 12.
Correct, sir.
Now, on your state plan, both the current assumptions and proposed assumptions, is that factored into both of those?
Yes, sir.
So we know that 30% hit in 08 is there, and so we can't expect in April all of a sudden you'll come back and say, well, now it's out of the system, we're up 2 or 3 points. It is included.
It is included.
Everybody got that on the committee?
Mr. Chairman,
everybody
good
with that? Okay. Steve?
I might also point out that 2011 created a negative bubble also.
And that'll take 5 years out.
That's exactly correct. And that's almost about $100 million a year. So we're going to be dealing with that for another 3 years.
But you factored that in, the effect on 1 year as you annualize it. I mean, not annualize it, but you smooth it out over 5 years, right?
Yep.
That
yep.
is correct, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Just on your current assumptions that jumped it up to 87%, did you smooth the 2012
absolutely,
positive
sir.
Earnings too?
Mr.
Okay.
Chairman, absolutely.
So I guess the next question is pretty obvious to me, but I want to just for the record, the reason the current assumptions look so much better by 2042 of 87% is because of the internal rate of return of 8%.
Correct. That's one aspect of
that. What are the other aspects?
Well, it's the positive earnings that we're reporting for 2012.
But you're not profiling those forward.
No. No, but Mr. Chairman, just the 1 year, achieving those that 1 year really makes a difference.
Correct. That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, continue, please.
Okay, and you'll see the impact in the right columns of those proposed assumptions. And I would just want to suggest that the board, with professional counsel, has considered the adoption of these new assumptions very, very carefully, because the economic assumption, the reduction in the assumed earnings rate by something so small as 25 basis points has a meaningful impact on the long-term funded ratio of the program, because that is compounded. That lower return is compounded over that 30-year period. And I believe the cost of these economic and interest assumptions is about 1.85% increase in contribution rate. And that translates into about a 2% decrease in the funded ratio.
I was looking at something. Say that again now, Tom. You're saying you're anticipating. Please repeat that.
What I'm suggesting is there is an impact, a negative cost impact of adopting these new assumptions. And that negative impact is about 1.85% in additional contributions required by the plan.
Okay.
And that also translates into an impact negatively of about 2% decline in our funded ratio. So an 82% funded ratio with these new assumptions would really translate into about an 80% funded ratio.
Okay. And how does that project out to 2042 with those same assumptions?
Well, yeah, with the same assumptions, the new assumptions, that's the column to your far right, it would be state plan would be at 59.5%. absent some level of infusion through increased
right.
contributions. And that is illustrated, of course, for the remaining major programs and showing you the impact. I think it's significant to note, however, that for several of our plans, that even with the adoption of these new, more conservative but eminently reasonable assumptions, that they still have funding ratios in excess of 100%, which is the target that has been broadly set for all of our programs. As you'll see here, the law enforcement program, even under the new assumptions in 2042, has about 105% funded ratio, judicial significantly higher, and Air Guard about 135%. Obviously, there are a few, including the state plan, that fall below that comfort level that you're looking for, which is generally about 80% and trending up. But we have as a goal, a stated goal, 100% funding. And the contributions that we've begun to discuss are designed to get us to that.
Okay. Senator Myers?
Tom, in 2042, that indeed those are still over 100%, but the trend line is down. So if you were to move that out to, you know, 2050, probably law enforcement would probably start to fall below 100%. And you know, so that the trend line is down. And I think that's one thing that we have to keep our eye on the ball, is that the trend line on these things stabilizes to either neutral or slightly positive. And looking at your comments that of 2042, if our goal was 87% by 2042 in the main plan, a 1.85 contribution level would probably get us to that 87% in 2042, barring any other changes, I guess.
I think that's a reasonable assumption. I'll defer to our actuary, who suggests yes.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, and another thing, I think at one time, I think up in Casper, we did a study if we just what the cost and contribution levels would be if we closed out the plan and paid it all out over 30 years. And I'm just wondering if, rather than a five-year bubble, if we structured the plan on a 30-year curve, whether that would what effect that would have, because that's the actual life that we're looking at. 5 years is kind of arbitrary just to kind of smooth it out, but if you actually had a 30-year rolling forward scenario where your gains and losses were averaged over the prior 30 years, and we started from the day forward and added that year and took the first year off and added another year on, what that would look like, because that's the life of the expected life of the contributions that have to be paid out or close to it.
I think and I'll invite our actuary to supplement my comments. I think the broadly accepted actuarial standard for smoothing gains and losses is really the 5-year period.
Right.
And very few organizations go beyond that to, say, even an 8 or 10-year smoothing period. We do, of course, forecast all of our liabilities as well as assets over that 30-year time frame. My sense is that we want to identify these trends in sufficient timeliness so that they can be responded to. I think that things can be happening in the program that if you're really measuring it over a 30-year time frame, you won't capture the kind of changes that are occurring in payroll, for example, or their hiring freezes over a short period of time that are sometimes then made up for in the subsequent period. So, you know, you can smooth some of these impacts out so marginally that they are not as discernible as you really rather have them, so that you can respond. So I think actuarially we look at our program from an experience perspective, both investment and otherwise, on a 5 to 8 year basis. The board's policy is to do it every 5 years, and in fact we've looked back for 5 years, but we had it done this year because we wanted to make sure that any recommendations or any discussions that we would have with you would reflect the most current and accurate information.
And Mr. Chairman, I think Tom is right from the standpoint, if you didn't have that look back that the board does, that you could, I guess, just wander around in the woods thinking everything's happy, more or less.
That could be a potential outcome. It'd be a little illusory, but
no, we're not wandering around. You're going to be the one to take us out of the woods. That's what we're trying to. The thing I want to be sure of is, and I heard what Senator Meyer said, but I don't see where we reflect that, and I understand what we now have in front of us on your January 10th letter. My question is very specific. If we add a 2% to the fund, that everybody in the state, I'm talking about the state fund, where would we be based on your current assumptions, our proposed assumptions, excuse me, where would we be by 2042? Are we, Kurt said 87% if it's 1.85. Have you done those calculations of what a 2% would do if it was effective, say, this fall, and what that would show for 2042?
Mr. Chairman, we have not. We have a version of that where we were asked to do 2% September 1, 2013, and an additional 2% on September 1 of 2014. We have that calculation. We could, fairly quickly get that. To the extent that our additional required contribution because of these proposed changes is about 2%, you know, one could infer that we would get to about that 87% under current sets of assumption. Well, to that 87% in 2042. But the danger is that there just is no guarantee that all of these interacting parts are going to behave the way we expect. And so we don't have any room for error in that kind of funding goal. And I think to the extent that we have set for ourselves a 100% target, we then have a cushion to at least mitigate some adverse consequences. I think it was fairly common amongst public pension plans in the period prior, let's just say the last 5 years or so, to accept that a program that was 80% funded or more, trended in the right direction, was a really healthy plan. And that's still the general belief as to, is my program sustainable? Is it healthy? But since 2008 and the kind of market declines that no one thought would and could happen, there is heightened sensitivity to putting in some level of buffer, some level of cushion in these plans. And our board has, even prior, had established as a funding policy that we ought to be at 100%, because even the COLA policy constraints that have been proposed will not allow us to even consider, you to consider, any distributions from the program in COLAs or other benefit increases if these plans aren't at least 100% funded after those distributions. So we think the 100% is the appropriate goal. How you get there? Do you get there this year, or is it 2% to make sure we're trending right and then contemplate another 2% at some future point? Certainly that's possible, and we could, in fact, give you those projections fairly
well. I'm only speaking for me, and I want everybody to jump in on this. But first of all, if we're going to err, you know, we're going to err on the side of being conservative. I think we all agree with that. But in the same sense, it doesn't make any – it's not a good idea for us to do more than we need to do, given the constraints we have budgetarily with the state, and put a lot of burden on our state employees that haven't seen a raise for 3 or 4 years. So that doesn't make sense. So I guess what I would ask, and you know, you are our experts, and I'd like to see if you could put together, because before we make any decisions, I think there's still some information that we need to get, and that information would be okay. If you wanted to be 100% at 2042, what do we need to do now based on your best estimate? That's one thing. The second thing is we have to live within the constraints of what might be doable. So I'd like to see the 2% that we talked about before, in September 13 to 2% of September of 14, what that might do to where that would put us out there. And then anything else, any other assumptions, I don't think we need to go. I mean, 7.75 is a pretty aggressive internal rate of return, but it's, I mean, that's what people are telling you, so we accept that. The mortality rates are included. There's nothing you can do about forecasting the ups and downs of the market. I don't know how any of us do that. So that would be my take, Mr. Co-Chair, of what we need, and let everybody jump in.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just for a quick second suggest that we have one of those illustrations already prepared, and that's the 2% in September of 13 and 2% of 14, and that gets us in 2042 to a 101% funded ratio under the big plan.
Mr. Chairman, that was my question. If you go to on that page 2 and 3 of your report, really the funds that it looks like that your suggestion we got to do something about is the big plan, Fire B and Wardens, and they're all at different levels. Pretty modest to Fire B, pretty substantial to the Wardens plan, it looks like. And that has all the new assumptions, new mortalities, everything's included in there.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
So that I think that is your bill, Mr. Chairman, the 2 plus 2.
It's there.
In the next, yeah.
I'm glad you said it was mine. Representative
Moniz.
Chairman,
say our.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, have you projected what if we don't do a 9-1 increase in 2013 and 2014? Maybe look at it down the road in 2015, 2016. Do you have any feel for what that might do to the plan going forward?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have not prepared that particular calculation because, as you could imagine, there are an infinite number of contribution possibilities. We could certainly do that. I think just from a practical perspective, we have the flexibility to defer some of these, but generally the longer one defers, the impact of the increase is mitigated somewhat because it's not in the plan, you know, long enough. If it's in there 30 years, it has a greater potential impact than if the increase is in 4 or 5 years. And obviously we have a 30-year open-ended amortization period, but we wouldn't get to the funding level that we're targeting as quickly. But could we get there? Absolutely, with the new assumptions, et cetera. And if this committee wants or desires some of these scenarios, if you give us a little guidance as to which ones you'd like, we could have those.
Mr. Chairman, follow up if I could. The only reason I ask that question is because of the economy and the impact it may have on the employees at the present time. It's the only reason I ask that question.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up on that a little bit. You know, and I think you alluded to it yourself, Mr. Chairman. You know, we are cognizant. I mean, asking for a 4% is a huge, huge thing. It is. We're not happy coming here and asking you for that. You're not happy to hear it, and nobody's happy to hear it, but we're not happy asking for it. But it's the best number we have at this time. But we also realize that it's a huge impact. No matter who pays for it, employers or employees, given the economic situation of the state right now, for both the employers and the employees, asking for 4% or 2% and 2%, that's huge. So, you know, as Tom said, there's no arguing that sooner is better than later. I mean, that's math. That we can't argue that. But given the situation we're in and given the level of commitment that we see from everybody that's involved in this, from the employees, employers, the governor, you guys, the level of commitment to make sure that this happens, you know, we can certainly live with a slower implementation of these contribution rates.
Just Mr. Chairman.
Just a second. Senator Perkins, then we'll get to you, Mr. Co-Chair.
And I don't know if you I don't know exactly how to ask this, but what I'm trying to figure out is, have you got, based upon the assumptions you have, do you have a multiplier of delaying of the effect of a dollar now versus a dollar 2 year now under the assumptions? There's something we can figure that out, because I mean that gets down to it. If we could have a kind of a rule of thumb under the assumptions of if you delay 1% or you delay a dollar 1 year versus, you know, push it 4 years down the road, compounding is just, it's a wonderful thing if you're getting it. It's a terrible thing if it's working against you. And so when you delay, I mean, even the delay of a 2 years, you kick the can down the road 2 years. And I think it's illustrated essentially, Mr. Chairman, really well by the fact that when you roll in just the effect or the benefit of this year and what a dramatic effect that has in 1 year, when that's broadcast out 30 years, it's dramatic. And you see it in your 30-year mortgage. You know, you'll pay for your house three times just about over a 30-year mortgage at about a 5 or 6% interest rate. So, I mean, those multipliers are there. And if we could get kind of, and that may be a way that you don't have to keep running back and doing a ton of iterations on for various scenarios, if we just have some multipliers about what the effect of the delaying something 1 or 2 years of a number.
Mr. Chairman, we would love it were such a rule of thumb available. I've just sought counsel from our actuary, and she has suggested that is not available to us. That, in fact, we can calculate what the impact of a 2-year delay is, but is there some, you know, multiplier, it'll cost you 1.8 times what it would have been. It's my understanding that there is not. But we can certainly provide an illustration of the two and two, perhaps, or other numbers you may suggest, begin in 2014 or 15. And those can be done and would be more accurate than, at least as I understand it, us developing a rule of thumb that does not exist. I think. Well, I think you're right, Mr. Chairman. Our actuary suggests they'll run the calculation and then give you the rule. So.
That sounds like what the legislature does sometimes. You know what I think we might want to do, and we don't want to create a lot of work that doesn't help us, but I think this is a big decision for all of us, and I'm not sure where we're going to go with this. We might have run a number that shows, you know, a one-year delay. Is it pretty to do a one-year delay and a two-year delay?
Sure.
What do you think? Would that help you, Senator Perkins?
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I think the point, the concern I have is that it's when you delay on these things, the compounding just eats your lunch. And so, you know, if you start to delay and you delay this action, my concern is that I just don't think you want to delay correcting this over beyond the amortization period, beyond the 30-year period. I think that's a breach of our fiduciary obligation, but when you delay it, obviously we're compressing that time, and the more you compress it, the more you have to. I think we'll find when we see the calculations, it's going to be dramatic. About if we delay this even a couple of years, I think it'll be fairly dramatic what the results will be. But that's my guess.
Well, and what you'll see, I think it could be that after you delay it 1 or 2 years, instead of 2% to get to the 100% in 2042, it might be 3, 4, or 5. But that'll be nice to see. Just a second, Senator Meyer. Mr. Co-Chair?
You know, I think
Representative Esquibel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and former Representative Pedersen, if you're out there listening, thank you for leaving me your question flag here.
Is that what that orange thing is?
This
that
is
you
the
wave
question
and
flag,
I'm supposed to pay
Mr.
attention
Chairman.
To. Thank you. I didn't know that.
And I guess what I'd like to see, Director Williams, is, you know, when you're talking about percentages, it may sound small, but are you able to show us on an average in these plans how much it would affect each of these paychecks, I guess, in dollars per month that is coming off the table for these individuals?
Tom?
Mr. Chairman, I think we could, but I think that's likely simple in some respects. It depends on if we have a 2% increase and it's paid by employees, it's going to reduce their checks by 2%, and it depends upon whether or not it is picked up by employers or if it's made generally on a tax-deferred basis so that then they don't pay the taxes on that contribution going into the retirement system. But it is a component of that percentage increase reduced by whatever the tax advantage is. So if we do 4%, our people are going to see a 4% decrease generally. In their checks, but obviously the checks of individuals vary based on numbers of dependents and income levels and the like.
Mr. Chairman,
Steve,
if I could add just one more thing, remember that the 4% is the best we can come up with right now to get to 100% funding in 2042. Next year, that's going to change. That 4%, that targeted contribution rate, whatever it is, whether it's 14% or 16% or 18%, it is a moving target. It's going to change every year. So to sit here right now and say, hey, we need to do this 4% right now, next year we can come back and say, hey, it wasn't enough, or we can come back and say it's too much. So a phased-in approach, in my opinion, is the right way to do it because it gives us more flexibility to get there. Now, it may cost a little more in the long run, but not knowing exactly where we're going to end up with that target every year, it may not cost us more in the long run. So, you know, and we've stressed this with the old committee and everybody that we've talked to, and I want this new committee to understand, that contribution rate is not a magic number. There is no, quote, number out there. It changes all the time. It's a moving target.
Yeah, and of course, the good thing is you can give us the information and we make the decision, and it's our fault or our being visionary. So we understand that. Senator Meyer, then Senator Hastert.
Tom, Steve, or staff, what is just the dollar figure on 1% of payroll?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe that's about $18 million.
About $18
million. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the phase-in approach, really, I believe with as Steve does, that's probably the right way. And I'm the problem that I have if we don't offer a pay raise with the increase in the contribution rate, if we require the employees to do that, you're going to see something else. You're going to probably see an increase in the amount of early retirees. So you're going to move a bubble through there that's a little bit different than the actuarial assumptions, because I guess I put myself in that position. If somebody's going to take 1 or 2% of my take-home pay away, I got to say, well, if I'm close to early retirement, I'm just going to opt out right now. So I think you're going to see some things that wouldn't show up in this in our assumptions, and you'd have to take those into account the next time. But I would think that one of the things that I'd like to maybe look at is what would be a 1% over 4 years? Because frankly, I don't think we've got $36 million and $36 million hanging around. But I think we could probably come up with $18 million and put that into a payroll raise and a 1% contribution for that the employees pay. Now, true, that's going to cost us a little bit more because we'd have to pay the FICA on that, but that would benefit the employees to the extent that if they weren't at 100%, they'd get the benefit of the FICA also. So, or and if we weren't going to do that, if we just do 1% and the state picks it up, and I think that was the program that was in the past because it was cheaper for us because we didn't pay the FICA and it didn't come out of the employee's pocket. But I think in these times when we can't offer pay raises or huge pay raises, we certainly don't want to be in a situation where we're decreasing the pay schedule of our employees. And I just lay that out for the committee to consider as a four-year plan at 1% and $18 million, and then we figure out whether it's coupled with a pay increase to the employees at the same rate, or whether the state picks it up. I think that's one option that we might consider and see how that may work.
Yes, Don, what I want to do is I'd like to see the difference between, and I think I know the answer, but we need to see it reduced in terms of the volume and the total dollar amount. Is if we did a 1% raise and then expected that to go back like Senator Meyer talked about, or if we just did a 1% and gave it to pay their 1% for the plan and see the difference in cost, and not only to the state but to the employee, and you know, and I understand what Senator Meyer's talking about, but let's just see what that number is so we can have an opportunity. Senator Hastert, you've been waiting patiently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to, I guess, just be reminded, if you could maybe just do a little re-education here, what the 100% means, and where did was that a number that we as the legislature asked to get to? That's not like a federally required number, is it? And what exactly does that mean? And I know there's going to be a lot of questions here on top of this, but you know, what is typically on a national level in each state is what the basic average of a retirement fund is. And what does it mean when it's 100%? What are the assumptions? Is how many people is that, like how many people are going to retire? I mean, we have I'm sure you have some kind of overview or an idea of projections for people that could potentially retire. It doesn't assume that, you know, everybody's going to retire on the same day when we're talking this. And I need to just kind of get this straight back in my head here a little bit of what these numbers mean. And when we talk about, you know, the 100% and what we're actually going to be doing and why we're going to do it to
the
employees.
Director, I think you review that some of that statute, I think, is where we go ahead.
Indeed, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much. Senator, you know, the 100% is not a mandated standard by the federal government. I think that we've talked in the past about an 80% funding level as sort of a baseline low target for when you're healthy and not, and depends upon the sort of trending. So, you know, there are lots of plans, some large ones, New York State Teachers Plan, number of others around the country that have in excess of 100% funding levels, and they are admired greatly, at least by those plans who have 40% funding levels. We think, and our actuary thinks, that the 100% target is the appropriate target for our and other public pension plans. But there are fiscal realities as to whether or not they can get there. I think the way our plan has been structured and managed in the context of benefit levels and the like, and the enhancement of the investment team, we have a very strong and reasonable shot to get to the 100%. But what it means is that there's no unfunded liability. You've paid your bills, and that you have enough money in the plan to cover all the promises that you've made. If you have, if you're 80%, it means you got 80 cents for every dollar you promised. So our goal is to have a dollar for a dollar, and that's the board's goal, and that is also set out in legislation, I believe, or as the intent has expressed.
The intent, could you just, I think the intent that we passed was that before you make a recommendation to come to us to even approve a COLA increase, that it will, after the COLA, remain over 100. Is that?
That
fair
is
statement?
Absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman.
So we passed that as a joint bill last year.
That is correct, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
Yeah, there's so much, you know, I mean, there's just so much information you got to keep reminding us. Okay, I think, you know, I think on page 3 of your handout, and it's a letter that was January 3rd, and you actually have it in two handouts, committee, but just on the costs of this, just maybe explain that. Real quick, or did you have further follow-up? Did I? I'm sorry if I.
Not at the moment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I think we were going down this cost issue a little bit, and I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about your. I think it's on page 3 of that, or 4, 5. It's a January 3rd letter, memorandum.
Okay.
Dick? Estimated actuarial cost study of 2%.
Oh, yes.
It's got a spreadsheet table there in the middle. And I think the committee has it in two forms. It's handout 153, and it's also stapled to your packet you gave us.
Yeah. We were asked to calculate the cost of the requested changes, the 2% and the 2% 2013 September, 2014 September, and to allocate it between the various component units of the state's budget. And I believe if you were to look at the chart, that illustration is provided. What's being shown here is the impact year by year of the roll-in of this new contribution rate. And it doesn't have the full effect, quite frankly, until 2015. Because in 2013, for example, the 2% only begins September 1, so you only have 4/12 of that year. And so in the next year, you have, and so that's 0.67% of the 2% contribution for year one. That's the impact. Year two, you'll have, you're folding in another, so I think it's like 2.67 in the next year. You don't have the full impact of the four until you get to 2015. But that is the cost in millions of dollars each of the fiscal years per component unit of the government.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could. That far right total for two-year period, I guess what is the biennialized cost then?
About $72 million, Mr. Chairman.
So it's more than there's if there was another total out there, it's more than that then.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this just shows the effect. I believe this is for calendar year 13 and calendar year 14, because that's our fiscal year. Okay?
Okay.
But once you get that whole 4% in there, it's $72 million a year.
$72 million.
That's right.
And how much of that is on the school side as
well,
foundation?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's part of the reason why we provided this component, so that you can take these numbers on the far right-hand column and, you know, take the $30 million and divide it by the 63, and that'll get you the school component of that. The schools is approximately 48-49%. Okay. I always use 50% as a rule of thumb.
Yeah, so about $35 million of that. So it's a $37 million biennial cost to the general fund to fully implement that.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, it's not. Remember, out of your say you, let's just talk on a 1% basis. Okay, 1% is $18 million bucks. 50% or $9 million is schools. Okay, the other 50% is divided into local governments and private nonprofits, state government and higher ed. State government and higher ed combined represent about 30% of the total. Now, not all of that is general fund money. If the employer were to pay that, you're not going to pay $30 million out of general fund.
Okay.
Or 30% out of general fund.
We're going to get those numbers in from the co-chair's request, and it's substantially less than that when you take out. And it seemed in my mind it was about a third then of the totals you looked at that. So.
Right. 30% of the total would be for, if you're looking at your general fund impact,
you
got to talk state government and higher ed, because general funds used for both of those. 30% of the total would be the total amount that those entities would be responsible for. But only a portion of that, and that's where you're going to have Don and Brett figure that out for you. Only a portion of that's going to be general fund.
Thank you.
Yeah, but if we do that, you know, the local governments are going to have to, if we raise that up in the requirement, it's up to them on how they do it, but they're going to have to certainly have an extra cost either placed on their employees, or they're going to have to pick it up themselves.
That's right.
So be sure and break that component out on that. And the other thing that's a little confusing on this number is what the, you know, so much per year, and I see $63 million on mine. You say $73 million, so that's confusing. But 63 is for the two-year period, assuming we do 2% and 2%, so then that's a 4%. So what would be the, if you look down the next cycle, what would it be per a biennial budget? I don't think that's clear in what you presented here.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, your observation's a good one. It's just because these 2 and 2% contributions are not in place for the full biennial. And so this $63 million is the cost as it would be phased in initially. But in subsequent years, absent pay increases and the like, it would be the $72 million.
Okay, be sure and make that distinction, Don, so we're able to see that.
The long term. We want the true cost of the general fund broken out. Just break it out by funds. We're going to school funds, all of it. Biennialized costs.
Okay, let's committee. Any other questions? Senator Perkins.
If going back to the proposal, it seemed to me that you're kind of gravitating. If I understood, we asked the board to run have their actuary run a 1% each year for the next 4 years. Is that what I understood?
No, what I asked for is if we delay it. You know, we delay it two, 1 year and 2 years based on the 2 and 2. That's one thing I asked for. Then,
Kurt,
did you want to do a 1% a year for 4 years? Is that what you asked for?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Perkins.
And I guess, I mean, whatever scenarios, I mean, you can run whatever scenarios that you want. But in the end, I think I would ask you to consider revising your instruction, because at the end of the day, I think at the end of the 30-year period, we still want to be at 100%. And so if you want the phase-in, I don't think the phase-in is to tell them you want 1% a year for 4 years or to have a phase-in. If you want the phase-in, tell them kind of where the parameters, what you want the phase-in, but at the end of the day, they need to come back and tell you what that phase-in needs to be so that we're at 100% at the end of 30 years.
Yeah, and of course, what we know is if we do 2% in this year and 2% in the next year, we're at 100%.
We
know
that. We got that.
We know that. So I guess maybe we can figure out a phase in that may achieve the same thing, but now it's so inaccurate anyway. But maybe that's a number that we could try to do. I wanted to show the impact of the delays and how that affects us, because it's pretty easy to see we do two and this year, two next year, we're at 100%. If we wait a year or we wait 2 years, we're not going to be anywhere near that. I think that's
right.
what that's going to show us. That's what I'm trying to get to,
okay.
Senator Perkins.
I mean,
but
at the end of the day, I don't know why we would adopt a plan, whatever we adopt, that wouldn't get us to 100%.
Yeah, I'm not saying that we would. I want to see the delay, but maybe there's a better way. Let's, just a second. Senator Meyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to qualify that assumption that we know today we'll be at 100% if we do two and two, and that goes right back to Steve's analogy about this is a moving target. This is a snapshot in time. That's all it is. We know today with these assumptions, with these current market rates, that we'll be at 101% in 2042. But we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. You know, it could very well be that we'll have 3 years at 12%, or it could be next year we'll have a minus 24%. You know, and so the thing is that the main thing that we got to look at is that we got a positive trend line. If we get a positive trend line and things are working in the right direction, then that snapshot in time is sometimes it's going to jump way up in our favor. And I can remember in the 90s we were at 111 or 114%. Of course, we had different assumptions. If we look at the 90s assumptions, we might be at 124% today because we've gone through two or three actuarial assumption changes. So we're just going to remember it's a snapshot in time. We know we need to make contributions. We need to decide what we can afford. The minimum, I think, is 1% a year. I'd like to do 2% if we can figure out two and two. If we can figure out if we can afford it, we need to do that. But if we figure we can't afford it, we need to at least at the very minimum do 1% a year.
Senator Hastert.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I still don't have my arms around why we have to be at 100%. You know, I don't quite get that. And, I mean, I understand that we put the bill in, and that's a pretty lofty goal, and it's great if you can get there. But is there, I guess, I really want to know, is there a real, other than that we put it in statute, I guess, is there otherwise a real need to do it? And I don't see that. You know, I'm still not convinced that why we have to do that. And then the other thing, too, is that do we have any of these, and I'm sure if somewhere in one of my charts or graphs that I could find somewhere, but are any of the systems at or exceeding 100%? And then if that's the case, then are they eliminated from the 2%? You know, is this like an across-the-board thing you're talking about?
Senator Hastert, that's all up in the air for us to decide. That's the purpose of hearing this, and if something's already at 100%, we're not going to take it to 120. The 100% magic number is just that. It's a magic number, and it will be long gone when we decide whether or not decisions we make in the next year or two are right. I mean, we all know that, and we understand that moving target. You know, pick a number. I mean, I think this is all open for some discussion. There's a lot of different parameters moving this discussion, but I think we have to have some basic understanding of levels and what the impacts are based on what we do, and that's all we're trying to get accomplished between now and if we move forward. And in order to do that, we have to have some kind of assumptions based on what they're telling us that they think will happen if we do certain things, and I don't know any other way to do it.
Mr. Chairman, just the other question that I had that it'd be nice to I would like to get answered just for myself is what's the national average on retirement system funds? You know,
I've done some work on that, and I've got some information I was going to bring to the committee next week because we've done that very study, you know, where people are, what they look at, and it's all over the place. But I can tell you that there's a number of states in this country that didn't make tough decisions when they should have. They're in a heck of a mess, and I don't think any of us want to be there. Did you have a comment, Mr. Co-Chair?
Well, I agree with you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I think really the part of the comment, the plans that we're really looking at are the big plan, Fire B, and Wardens. Those are the ones where the trend lines, as Senator Meyer talked about, are not going in the direction we'd like. And then I just one more comment, Mr. Chairman, is that in that in your handout number 95, I think, this was our budget amendment from last year? It wasn't our, yeah. And that's just a review for the committee there. It's in that handout 95 that said you'd come back and our goal of 100%.
Right. And, Mr. Chairman, with respect to that, you know, that was our take on on that budget footnote. We've given that to your staff, and I'm sure that they're going to work that over and get back to you on it. So.
Okay, we've had some great discussion. Before we, I'm going to do a couple of other things here. Is everybody on the committee comfortable with the information and understand the information we're going to ask staff to provide for us? Don, why don't you tell me what you think we just said?
Mr. Chairman, LSO and the Budget Office, which we've already done a fair bit of work up, will prepare a cost of 1% that's easily multipliable to per year for a cost of retirement versus a cost of compensation and the differences therein. We'll do that by fund as well as by entity. So if the local government, school districts, other funds, federal funds, general funds. I believe the Department of Retirement will provide you with a one-year and two-year delay, as well as...
Tom and Steve, you listen to this? Just, okay.
Mr. Chairman, a one-year and two-year delay, and secondly, a one-year or 1% for the first 4 years, and then 4% thereafter, and see... This will give us the 90% of the achieved level or something. That will not get to Senator Perkins' inquiry. So if you wanted to add a third, we could add that.
I don't think we need that. I think just we'll just do that. Our staff will do our side of that. Tom, Steve, if you could do your side, and we'll have, you know, committee, this is very, very important. And you know, you guys are busy, but do we want to have, if once we get this information, would we like to have that have them back to discuss it further? I think we do, Mr. Co-Chair. I think we're gonna like to have you come back again. I mean, we like to see you in a lot for a lot of reasons, but this is a good one. So kind of plan on that, and we'll kind of see where we do. Well, let's work this over the weekend. We can probably have. When do you think you can have your numbers, Tom? Don't say next session, please.
Well, it'll be earlier than that, Mr. Chairman. We're going to put pressure on our actuary. And when I say pressure, let me tell you, they've been incredibly responsive to
us.
Yeah,
I understand.
And has turned around these kind of projections. I don't know what they've got in the hopper, but I'm going to bank that in a week or two we ought to be able to.
Oh, we can't do a week or two.
Well, how about we'll do it sooner? We'll I can't speak for them, but I'll tell you, best guess.
Tell me when you need it, and I'll get it. Wednesday. Is that good?
Well, that's better in next session or 2 weeks.
I understand. We'll target that, Mr. Chairman.
We'll target that, but staff, we're going to have ours quicker.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Yeah. That was not a question, Don.
Mr. Chairman.
Steve.
One more thing before we leave. I mean, so these are all... with respect to the big plan, but as Co-Chairman Harshman pointed out, we still have two other plans that we need to do something with. So,
no, we're inclusive.
Those are part of the discussion.
Okay,
that's
so
part of the discussion.
Those three.
Okay, so
they're not near the impact, but yeah, we want to do them all. Let's
okay.
do it right from the front end.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
I'm just curious. I would kind of like to know what the governor's position is in terms of how addressing the issues that we're confronted with. Do we want to make a request to them?
Well, you're kind of reading my mind because that's the next thing I'm going to get into here. You're always ahead of me, Bob. That's good. Anything else for the retirement board and staff on this particular issue? Committee, anything? Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead, Tom.
Mr. Chairman, I think there were a couple of other potential bills that you've asked us to review. One relates to rehired retiree proposed legislation, and I believe there may be a bill related to paid fire A and the COLA that's provided under that. To the extent your desire, we're able to talk to those two bills, and if you would elect to do that at the point we return, we're happy to do that as well.
No, we're not going to do that. We're going to do one of them today, and I hope you can stick around because we're going to have Matt Obrecht here to go through that bill. It's on the double dipping. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
We've got that today, so we'd like to have you stick around and comment on that. Steve?
When are you going to take that up, Mr. Chairman?
We're going to do it today before 10. We're going to get right to that. Okay, so stick around. Anything else for Tom and Steve on this issue at this point? Committee?
I think, Mr. Co-Chair, too, I think there's still that interest in that self-funded COLA idea through the 457. and we haven't really got a bill worked up how we want to look at it, but at some point we got to kind of decide if that's something or if that's on the back burners, you know. So just kind of a reminder to the committee.
Yeah, and the other thing, and this is the, I'm not making things more complicated, but I know that in the past what we did is we offered early retirement things to do things that could help and all that and have fewer state employees. And, I mean, there's just so many variables. But let's stick with what we got for now. And please stick around just for a second. We're going to get to that bill. But before we do, Carrie, you're here. Is there anything or bill from the governor's office that you would like to comment on at this point in time? And we've had some great discussion, and we sure want to afford you that opportunity if you would like.
Mr. Chairman, the governor asked Bill and I to be here today because we're interested in the answers to the same questions this committee's interested in. This is, as you suggested, a really important topic. It's a serious obligation of the state. We're visiting with retirement in conjunction with you on this issue. We want to understand it, make sure to the best of the ability that the right decision is reached. So I think that the governor would tell you thank you for your questions and for the look you're taking at this. We're taking the same look. And so that would be our position, that we just are wanting to be cautious. We want to make the right decision, and we want to explore this with you.
Just a second before you leave. Anybody have any questions of Carrie? I get, Mr. Co-Chair,
well,
go ahead.
So, Carrie, I think, so you haven't taken a position on the compensation piece. I mean, the governor has a proposal on compensation versus, you know, compensation and a potential 2 or 4% pay decrease as well. Have you taken any position on that?
I think the discussion on retirement and the need for increased contributions first came to light before this committee in December. That was the discussion that the governor's office has had with retirement relates to Steve Summers' statements to this committee is this is a snapshot in time. The discussion we've been having is it 2%. The answer we received is we don't know if it's 2%. What would happen if it was 1%? And in response to Senator Perkins, our understanding is that depending on how investment returns come around and whether or not these assumptions change next year, and they're always subject to change, that is, in fact, not a magic number, that it is not necessarily 2% and 2%. It's not 1% and 1%. That's kind of an unknown. And my understanding of the discussion as it was fleshed out here today is that that's the same question you have. So what's the right number?
I think, I think more specifically it was more about the compensation piece. The governor's recommended around $12 million for compensation for state employees. There's a couple ways to compensate employees. One, you pay their retirement for them, or you compensate them and take it out of their paycheck. And I think that was really that's going to be a big policy issue we're going to grapple with here.
I think that where this discussion comes, Mr. Chairman, is going to make a big difference in that discussion. The pay proposal that's in the governor's recommendations, it does not equate to a 2% increase for state employees, University of Wyoming, or the judiciary. It's less than that. It's 1.75% for some people. That recommendation was made before this discussion arrived, and so, in fact, that pay proposal would not make state employees whole, let alone give them a pay raise. I just think that's something that we're going to have to discuss as these two meld together, and I think that we're I think at this point to give an answer is that the governor certainly supports that increase, but he intended it to be an increase, not to make people less than whole.
Just a second, Carrie. Anybody else? The only thing I would add is and we can talk more as we get through this and get these numbers by next Wednesday, and we'll have a discussion, is that, you know, the governor may very want to send us a letter, and I'm sure he will, as to where he really is, so there's no question in our mind what you all want to do from the governor's office. This is some great discussion and pretty serious. So anything else then? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, what we're going to do now, committee, is we're going to look at our draft bill on, it's called Public Employees Requirements Upon Rehiring. And just for everybody's information, what this is it's just a draft. We're not going to vote on it today. We're not going to take any action on it today. We're going to have Matt Obrecht walk us through the bill. We're going to ask questions of Matt so the whole committee is aware of what we're doing, the joint committee. And then if there's an if there's an interest, what we're going to do with this is take it to the Senate Appropriations Committee. And if the Senate Appropriations Committee has an interest, we're going to put this in the hopper as a bill. And so what I want to do now, Matt, is have you walk us through the bill. And Tom stepped out for a second. But, Steve, if you have any comments specifically because of your involvement, we're not going to take testimony today on this bill as such. We're going to just talk about it, get some general feelings from you. And then if we decide to move forward, there will be ample time during the normal process. We have a committee hearing. We'll hear the bill. We'll take public testimony and see if the bill has any life or any legs under it to move forward. So with that, absent any questions from anybody from the committee, hearing none, Matt, walk us through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're discussing 13 LSO 203 L4. And by way of quick background for the committee, currently in statute, when a retiree of the state pension plan has a break in service, he is not eligible to be rehired and continue to receive retirement benefits if he's rehired within less than 30 days of his break in service. After that 30 days, he's eligible to be rehired by an employee who contributes to the state pension plan. But if he is hired in a position that is a normally contributing position to the retirement plan, his employer pays both the employee and employer contributions for that rehired retiree.
And he would continue to receive his retirement.
And he continues to receive his retirement benefits. Plus,
just so I heard that, I thought they just paid the employer share. The employer pays the employer and currently and employee share if they rehire, paying the 14 point whatever it is. Or
Matt,
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
No, go ahead. That's correct. Repeat that, please. We're all clear on that, would you?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. The employer rehires a retiree after the 30-day break in service pays both the employer and the employee contributions. That way, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, the policy is to keep the retirement system whole as if they had hired a normally contributing member in that position.
Just a quick, so for my understanding then, but once that person is taken retirement, those contributions, that those new contributions, we say, after the 30-day separation, those can't be received in any way by this employee, right? Those just go into the system.
Mr. Chairman, any additional service after he receives retirement benefits, unless he takes the election to cancel his retirement benefits while he is a rehired employee and make contributions to the system, then he would pay in his employee share of whatever his new salary is, along with and the employer would pay the employer's share. That would raise his retirement benefits when he separated or had a break in service from the job he was rehired for.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but if he did that, then does his new salary he's getting paid get factored into his calculation?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it does. But that,
okay.
Again, Mr. Chairman, he's not receiving retirement benefits during that period.
Oh, I see.
He
so
becomes
he
a contributing member again to
okay.
the system.
So he's not taking, he's not double dipping, in fact.
At that point in time, no, Mr. Chairman.
But
I'm sorry. I'm just so I understand. So once the double dip occurs after the 30 days, he can no longer adjust his retirement benefits.
That's correct.
They can't go up or they can't go down. Okay.
That's correct, Mr.
That's
Chairman.
Smart on them.
And the bill draft has the exact same provision in it.
Well, but that's not what you just said. What you said is if they, in fact, make the election to go ahead and stop taking their retirement check and pay into it, then at the point in time when they finally do retire again, that the amount of money they're receiving then would be figured into their calculation for what they would receive.
And that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so, now that we're all really clear on this.
I just want to, Mr. Chairman, so just so I understand the system, so you could actually take retirement and double dip for a few months and then say, no, I don't want to take retirement. I want to start paying back in.
Mr. Chairman, that's not my understanding. No, once you are rehired,
past your 30-day break in service, you have to make an election at that point
decision.
In time.
You're either in or you're out. You're double-dipping or you're contributing more.
That's correct.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Tom, while we're talking like this, do you agree?
Yes and no, Mr. Chairman. Sounds like one of the answers you received a minute ago. As I understand it, and as the program currently works, after the 30-day separation, an individual does have the option to either they start their benefits, let's say, after the 30 days. If they are considered for reemployment, they have a choice at that time as to whether they will suspend benefits and have additional compensation calculated toward their retirement benefit. But we also have to remember that they get an actuarial reduction for anything they've already received. So if a person had been retired for, let's say, a year or two, and they got rehired, and we've been paying them their monthly benefit for that two-year period, then when they resumed their benefit, they'd probably have an actuarial reduction because they, in fact, had received monies for 2 years already. So it is possible but highly unlikely that people actually increase their retirement benefit by being a rehired retiree. And as I understand the operation of this proposed bill, it would prevent individuals who are rehired after the break in service of less than 1 year from electing to continue to receive. It would require a suspension of their benefits. In other words, the double dipping, as I understand it, would not occur because this bill requires that they suspend. They had the option before to suspend or not, but as I understand the operation of the bill, they'd have no choice but to suspend the benefits if they wanted to return to employ in a position that would otherwise have been covered by the Wyoming retirement system.
Okay, well, let's go through the bill.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
Just
wait a minute. I'm running the meeting here. Okay, hold on. I want to go through the bill, and that's what we're going to do now. So, Matt, walk us through the bill.
Mr. Chairman, starting on page 2, 93415, the change to subsection A just specifies that except as provided in this section or under 93431 or 432, and that is the firefighter and law enforcement retirements, when normal retirement benefits under the system become payable. The change in B provides the same amendment in this section and also adds 93431, which is the firefighter member, and that's really just a cleanup amendment there, Mr. Chairman. In subsection J, First Amendment adds the new subsection G, and at the bottom of the page begins to strike 30 days, which goes over the top of page 3 and inserts 1 year. So a retired employee who will return to state service after a break in service of more than 1 year with a participating employer to fill in any capacity, any position for which contributions to the retirement system would normally be required shall notify the retirement board. Subsection H, and the amendments to this can be thought of as the grandfathering clause in this bill. If prior to July 1st, 2013, a retired member is rehired by a participating employer, and again, participating employer in the state pension plan, to fill a vacant full-time position or a regular contributing employee in any capacity, and the retiree is rehired following a break in service of not less than 30 days, the employer shall pay into the account an amount equal to both the employer's or the member's and the employer's contributions required by law based upon the retiree's salary. And again, service under this section for the rehired retiree will not increase that retiree's retirement benefits. On the top of page 4 is the new subsection J, and this applies to on or after the effective date of this act, July 1st, 2013, a retired member is rehired following a break in service of not less than 1 year. So the retiree will not have any state employment for at least 1 year, and he's rehired by a participating employer to fill in any capacity any position for which contributions to the retirement system would normally be required, and the member does not elect, again, does not elect to discontinue receiving retirement benefits and be reinstated as a contributing member. So this bill draft does have that provision within it, that the retiree can elect to become a contributing member to the system. The employer shall pay into the account an amount equal to both the employer and the member's contributions required under statute. And again, unless that member was to elect to suspend receiving retirement benefits and become a contributing member of the retirement plan again, that this service will not increase retirement benefits under the Wyoming retirement plan. Starting on line 15, existing subsection J is renumbered as subsection K, and it says the board shall immediately cancel the retiree's retirement benefit and shall reinstate the member as a contributing member. First, if any retired member or employer violates subsection H or J of this section. Two, if prior to July 1st of 2013, any retired member is rehired by a participating employer to fill a vacant full-time position of a regular contributing employer in any capacity, and that retiree has not had a break in service has a break in service of less than 30 days. And three, if after the effective date of this act, July 1st, 2013, a retired member is rehired by a participating employer following a break in service of less than 1 year to fill in any capacity any position for which contributions to the retirement system would normally be required. Starting on line 13, existing subsection K is renumbered subsection M, and this deals with early retirement, and there's no other changes to that subsection. Starting on the top of page 6, a new subsection N is created, and it's a definition section. Defines for purposes of this section and notwithstanding any other provision of the article, in any capacity includes but is not limited to a contract employee or an employee of a third-party contractor under an agreement with a participating employer. So that means if a retiree is hired in any capacity, as a contract employee or as a third-party contractor, if they're hired within 1 year after the effective date of this act, then they will have to become a contributing member of the system again and suspend their retirement benefits. If they're hired after 1 year in a break of service, their employer, and even if they're hired as a contract employee, their employer will have to pay the full contribution. The other definition is any position for which contributions to the retirement system would normally be required. And this shall not include temporary or part-time employment unless the position for which that retiree is filling is normally classified as a temporary or part-time position for which contributions to the retirement system are not required by this act or rules adopted pursuant to this act. So my understanding, and this is a generalization, and it's not 100% true all the time, but a temporary employee or position is one under 6 months of employment, and part-time position is 120 hours a week or less.
And that's the bill.
Just one other part, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Section 2 is the applicability provision, and this is our attempt to make sure that any retiree who has already entered the system prior to the effective date of this act, we are not impacting what benefits they have already begun to receive under the law as it stood at the time they retire. So this provides that the provisions of this act shall not be applicable to any to persons retiring in accordance with 93401 through 93432 prior to the effective date of this act and rehired following a break in service of at least 30 days and less than 1 year. This would apply to a person who, say, may retire April 1st and be rehired May 15th, but not have a break in service of 1 year past the effective date of this act. And that's the bill.
Okay, thanks, Matt. All right, let's open it for discussion. Question, Senator Meyer.
Matt, committee, several areas. One, I'll go with the easy one first, maybe, and that's the penalty provisions down on page 4, lines 20 and 21. The penalties only refer to subsections H and J. They don't, however, refer to subsection G, which is the notification section. So I guess if you don't notify the board that these folks are actually working in these capacities, there's no penalty. And so there's no way you can find out. So I'm just wondering whether or not we should include subsection G in the penalty section so at least they have to notify you, because otherwise you don't know whether there is or isn't a penalty.
Matt?
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that's something to consider, but what we don't want to do is create a penalty whereby someone, their employer is actually making the contributions, but they never notified the retirement system that they've hired a retiree, and then make that, you know, if they're meeting the spirit of the law, but maybe not the black letter of it, we wouldn't want to penalize them and make that employee forfeit or suspend their retirement benefits in that situation just for a violation of forgetting to notify the retirement board.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I'm thinking that there should we should have some penalty in some way, and I'm not sure how we address it, just to make sure that there's some consequences for not notifying. And I'm not sure what that will be, but that's maybe a discussion we could have, Mr. Chairman.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would just mention that currently in statute there is the notification requirement and the penalty requirement, and current statute does not require suspension of retirement benefits for a simple failure to notify.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty tough because they just sit and send in a form, they lose all their retirement. I don't think we want to do that. Go ahead, Senator Meyer, you got another question?
The other question, I think we have a conflict over in subsection G. If you read back in on line 2.
Which page?
Line 2, page 3. In any capacity, and then that's further defined essentially as almost as a stricken language that's been stricken in this. And if you go in any capacity is back on page 6, line 4, and it says includes but is not limited to a contract employee or an employee of a third-party contractor under agreement with a participating employer. Mr. Chairman, I believe those folks normally would not be required to pay contributions into the retirement system. But if you look on subsection G, top of page 3, essentially you just reinsert the stricken language. You kind of got a contradiction there because you say in any capacity, which means a contractor, which doesn't have the requirement for a contribution, but then you go on and say for which contributions to the retirement system would normally be required, shall notify. I think the simple fix is just to strike out the inserted language on lines 6 and 7 and just say that if they fill a position in any capacity, then they shall notify the board in writing. And then you don't have a conflict between a position which contributions are would normally be required and the definition in any capacity.
And Mr. Chairman, again, G is just the notification requirement to the retirement board. But if they're hired in what is normally a position that would not be a contributing position to the retirement benefit or to the retirement plan, retirement board would not, you know, keep track of that position, who's filled in it, and what contributions are getting in that position. So there would be no need, if you were hired in a position that didn't normally pay into the system, to notify the board of that fact that you'd been hired in that position.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me give you a little history on that. The history on that is that this was exactly what was going on, is that an employee would basically terminate, go on the payroll for the retirement system. And then they'd come back as a contractor, filling the exact same requirements, the exact same workload, everything's the same except it's to a contractor. And in some cases, these were folks that didn't actually work for anybody else. They just hung their shingle out saying, now I'm an expert in this, and they go back in a facility and do the same duty. So if the board doesn't have to notify the retirement board, then you don't know that these guys are actually violating other sections of the law of rehiring someone, because they're essentially rehiring someone and double dipping. They're just using a contract to do it. And so you got to have that notification to stop the double dipping by contract.
Okay, Wally, we can see that we got some discussion going on. Matt, do you care to comment to that?
And Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Meyer makes a valid point that, and again, this is just the notification requirement, but essentially what you would create is that if here's the situation you would have. If you're a retiree and you're hired to work as a session staff of the legislature, you would then be required, even though that's not a position for which contributions to the retirement system are normally required, you would have to notify the retirement board of your employment.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions on the proposed legislation from the committee? Okay, Tom, do you have any comments at this point in time? You know, if we decide to move forward, you'll have plenty of opportunities later. Any quick comments you'd like to make? Turn on your mic, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We are supportive of the bill generally. It has been refined to cover positions that may not have been captured before, because there are some entities that cover their part-time, cities, towns, counties. Some do not. So we wanted to make sure when we included this language of any capacity for which contributions would normally be made, it's a little more comprehensive than was there prior. We are pleased with that. And this does protect the system in the context of fiscal integrity by requiring the resumption of contributions on behalf of either employers when people are rehired. So we don't have any fiscal concerns with the structure of the bill. I think that in some instances, employers may feel as though it takes away some of their flexibility, but that's for the employer to argue and not us. We're pleased with and supportive of the bill.
Mr. Co-Chair.
And we'll have time, too, but what's the fiscal impact of this right now? Are there lots of folks out there? I mean, we all hear anecdotal. There's a few in my community that are high profile that everybody saw. Are there...
Mr. Chairman, there is no fiscal impact, as I understand it, because we require rehire retirees to their employers to make the contributions that they otherwise would have made. I believe at the end of last year there were about 266 individuals in so-called retiree roles.
Is it possible to kind of show us that salary band of those guys? I mean, I don't think it's folks in the real lower salaries necessarily in my mind. The ones I know are all the ones who are making pretty good salaries anyway. Is there a way to kind of show us that information?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to explore that with our staff because there are some systems limitations.
Sure.
As you know, we're
and I don't want to put you through a bunch of work on, but we always get a list of state salaries, those kind of things. It'd be interesting to just see. I've heard lots of stories, and the ones I do know are high paid employees. But thank you.
Well, we have to make a decision as a matter of public policy what we want to do, and what we want to be sure is that we have a bill that accomplishes what we want, obviously. But the reason we want your involvement is we want to don't have any negative impacts to the retirement system. You know, we have enough going on there anyway, so that's certainly something we want to do. Okay, committee, any other comments? Excuse me, any other comments on this proposed legislation? What do you want to do? Co-chair, you got any strong feelings? I'm prepared to move forward.
Well, it'll have to be a Senate file, and then I'm sure you guys will make it better before it gets to us.
Senators, absent any objection? Okay, what we'll do is, Don, let's go ahead and prepare this for a Senate file. Matt, would you please? And do we have to take a vote as a joint committee or just as a Senate Appropriations Committee? What do we have to do on that situation? I think we have to be in meeting and be duly represented and all, and we could do it at noon today, and I think that's the way I want to do it. But you agree, Matt?
Mr. Chairman, that would be the advice of LSO.
Yeah. So what we'll do today, we're going to meet on some re-referrals, so we'll take up that vote today, senators, and if we have an affirmative vote, then we'll prepare a Senate file and it'll go through the process. So everybody understand what we're trying to do? Senator Perkins?
Just a question I have is, do we have to vote as a joint committee and then
sign
here, we just move it, we can be a Senate committee bill?
We can't do a joint committee bill anyway. It's too late, so... Okay, that takes care of that, and we'll bring this up for discussion. And anything else that we got to do right now, Don? Okay, go ahead, Don.
No, Mr. Chairman, just a notification that your next scheduled meeting is at 9 a.m., where you will address the district attorneys on Monday morning.
Okay, we have that schedule for Monday. It has been distributed to us, or will be. Okay, well, get that to us. But it's 9 o'clock. It's your show. Is that what time you want to go, Steve?
9 o'clock, yeah.
9 o'clock Monday. So we're adjourned until 9 a.m. Monday, whatever. What is that, the 13th? 14th. Monday the 14th. Good week, committee. Thank you. And members of the public out there that are interested in this bill, we'll see, if we decide to sponsor it. But if we do, it'll be out there, and we'll look forward to your comments and concerns or input. Thanks, Tom and Steve, and you get that information. I remember by Wednesday, that'd be Wednesday next week.
That's what we'll do, Don,
let's think about when we'll call back on this for sure, and Steve and I'll get together with you and give you so we can have some more discussion about this, because this is pretty important. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're adjourned.